It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
What a great week. First of all, Lucha Underground is coming back for a second season on El Rey Network early next year. They start filming back at the Temple in Boyle Heights in December. I am beyond thrilled to hear that, as people who listen to this podcast I'm sure will find not the least bit surprising. And my Mets, back in the postseason for the first time in 9 years. National League Eastern Division champions. Almost 30 years since their last World Series title. That's a long time. Not as long as the Cubs. For those of you Chicago dwellers, I feel your pain. Not as long as the Cubs, but still a very long time. And they're going to go all the way. The pain of that series with the Cardinals in 2006, as a fan, it just doesn't get any worse than that. I mean, that was a Mets team that should have won it all. You know, I was at Game 2 of the NLCS that year against the Cardinals, and having a lead, letting it slip away the way that they did, Billy Wagner giving up that home run, I can't even talk about it. You know, taking the 7 train home that night, it was like a funeral. You have never seen a train so quiet in your life. Anything that could help erase the memory of that season is fine with me, and I think this team has done a hell of a job of that. You know, that Cardinals team won 83 games that season. This Mets team already has 88, so there's no reason to think they can't pull this off. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm just enjoying the ride right now. It's something I'm not used to, this whole winning thing. Feels good. I want to give a shout-out to the guys at Five Borough Wrestling. I was at their show on Friday night in Brooklyn to watch that fat bastard who killed my knees last month get his comeuppance. Kevin Nash was supposed to be wrestling, but he showed up and was moving around like Andre the Giant. So he came out for the main event. He joked that he had injured his quad, which was a reference, sadly, that seemed to fly over everybody's heads, but I laughed. He said he was hurt, but that the Click always prided itself on delivering for the fans when one of them was unable to compete, you know, probably because they were in no condition to wrestle. And so he introduced X-Pac as his replacement, and to be honest, it was a much better match with Waltman in there than it would have been had Nash wrestled. One of the most surreal things I've seen all year happened on the show. It was the sight of Kevin Nash entering the ring and being showered in streamers. He was all happy. He got on the mic. He said, "I feel like I'm back in Tokyo." So I think it's safe to say that the streamer craze has officially jumped the shark. Actually, I think the expression "jump the shark" has officially jumped the shark. But that is something I thought I'd never see before. Kevin Nash being showered in streamers at an indie show. I have now seen it all. We started a little something special on the show last week. We're going to continue it this week. I mentioned that on November 8th, that date will mark the 8-year anniversary of the Sound Off podcast. And so, in the 8 weeks leading up to that show, each week, I said that I would be doing a countdown and naming one of my 8 favorite matches. Not in wrestling history, specifically in WWE history. We're keeping it limited to WWE. And again, this is not a countdown that's in any kind of particular order. I'm not ranking them from, you know, 8 being the least favorite to number 1 being the most favorite. As you could tell, being that last week we started with maybe my favorite match of all time, which is the 1992 Royal Rumble match. And a thank you to everybody who sent in feedback about that. I really appreciate it. So this week, we will have match number 2 that I will reveal after the mailbag at the end of the show as we continue our little 8-year anniversary countdown. First, I got to give some love to Audible, a very fine partner, audible.com, where you can download up to 180,000 different audiobook titles if you are into that sort of thing. It doesn't have to be a wrestling book. It could be any kind of book. A lot of people have been taking me up on our URL to get their free Daniel Bryan book. His book is up there in audio form. He narrates a good part of it. I have the, not the audiobook version, but a different version of the book that I'm hoping to break into shortly. I've heard nothing but great things about it, so get on that. audibletrial.com/solemonster. You can use it yourself. If you've already taken advantage of the 30-day trial and the one free audiobook that you get as part of that trial, do the sound off a favor and pass that link around to friends and family. Anybody who you think may be interested in sampling the service, if they, you know, again, want to download a book for free. I don't know anybody who wouldn't want to download something for free. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Spread that link around. And again, you can choose up to one free audiobook that you get to keep, even if you cancel during the 30-day trial period. It is a win-win situation for everyone. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster is the URL to use for that. Also got to give a shout-out to the people who made PayPal donations this week. You can do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side of the page. It is always parked there. It does not move. Nobody gives it a parking ticket. It's never towed. It's always there. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. $30 or more, and you'll get not only a shout-out and a nickname, but a quick plug for your own podcast or YouTube channel, business, what have you. Thank you to Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Deadpool James Herrera, Hytham the Equalizer, Al Nawasser, the Australian Ass-Kicker, Anthony Patty, Tarkin Danger Zone Davis, Case Closed, Aaron Kloss, Dashing David Vera, Ground Assault, Philip Trebzinski, Hard to Beat Daniel Belenki, and John Loose Cannon Lopez. Thank you so very much for your very kind donations to the show this week. And like I said, you can always make a donation any time of day on thesolomonster.com. Last Sunday was the WWE Night of Champions pay-per-view. For those of you who may have missed it, I did a Sound Off Extra review of the show that's up on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolomonster. Please subscribe when you go to that channel. If you missed the video, you would not have if you were already subscribed, so get on that. Overall, I thought it was a pretty decent show, not a blowaway show by any means, but I saw people heaping a lot of hate on it, maybe because of the ending. I didn't hate the show, but it also didn't, you know, knock my socks off or anything like that. And of course, the situation with Sting, which we'll get to in a second, was very unfortunate. Quick update, though, on the idiot who jumped into the ring before the Shield match with the Wyatt family, in case you missed that part. Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose were in the ring with the Wyatts. They were about to introduce their mystery third partner, which turned out to be Chris Jericho. And before they could introduce Jericho, we saw somebody appear in the ring, standing next to Roman. He was dressed in a flak jacket, I think, Shield-type gear. At first, I thought he was the partner. I think a lot of people did. And then he was quickly tackled, and we realized it was another idiot fan hopping the barricade, trying to make a name for himself. Well, he was arrested, and the guy pled guilty to one charge of criminal trespass and was sentenced to 10 days in jail. Unfortunately, between time served and good behavior, he was out in three, which is not long enough at all. I went on a whole rant in that YouTube video. You'll hear it in the Night of Champions video that I did, just on fan safety and what has to be done. And, you know, again, my suggestion, which I floated before, of locking them in a room backstage with Mark Henry, preferably a Mark Henry who has not eaten in about 3 days, would be my punishment. Now, this guy who's out now was interviewed by the Wrestling Mayhem show. They spoke with him online. And the guy, this is what the guy said. The guy said about what he did, "It's just a test to see how far I would go or what lengths I would go to for the WWE universe." What a psycho. I mean, real, and he's using WWE jargon now. What a psycho. They even had screen caps of some of the guy's Facebook statuses from the last few months that show he was clearly planning this for a while. This was not an impulse thing. Hey, you know, looks like, you know, this could be fun. No, he was planning this for a while. His last status was actually the night of the pay-per-view. He wrote, "It's either go big or go to jail tonight. It's on." And then like 5 exclamation points. Why not go big and go to jail? They should have gone with a hybrid mix of my idea and locked Mark Henry in the same cell with him for those 3 days. And make it a really, really small cell. Go big or go to jail. What a fucking loser. As for Sting, here's the update on Sting. In his own words, WWE.com did an interview with him on Wednesday. Aside from a stiff neck, he says he feels pretty good. He wasn't feeling good that night. He was in a tremendous amount of pain. But and by his own admission in this interview, he mentions when they took him to the hospital, they were pumping him full of pain meds. So he must have been in quite a bit of pain. He says he had tingling and numbness down both of his arms. Later in the match, it went down to his legs. That's why, if you remember, when he took the second buckle bomb and came out of the corner, and then later on when Rollins whipped him into the ropes and he came off, he just collapsed. You know, his legs looked like rubber. He collapsed under his own weight. And that's why in the hospital that night, they were pumping him full of pain meds. Like I said, he had a CT scan. He had an MRI done. They mentioned cervical spinal stenosis as a diagnosis of what he has. And I don't know if that's... It's not like you get spinal stenosis from an injury that took place that night. I think that's just something that in doing all of the tests they discovered he had, maybe it was, you know, made worse by what happened here. But I think it's almost a situation where after years and years and years of wrestling, they discovered that he has this condition. And that's not good to have, you know, spinal stenosis of any kind. He admits his doctors were talking more with his wife, not him, so he may not have the entire picture. He's just kind of going by what he was told or what he remembers. The doctor told his wife he's going to have to get this dealt with. He's very lucky to have even walked out of there on his own 2 feet. Spinal stenosis is what ended Steve Austin's career. It's what ended Edge's career. In the case of Edge, he didn't have a choice. They said, you have this, you're done. We're not going to clear you. We're not going to let you wrestle. Period, end of story. And so at 37 years old or 38, he was done. Austin made the choice. He was done. I don't know that he was told, hey, we're not going to clear you, but he, you know, had all kinds of neck problems, and it was the spinal stenosis that did it. And that's something that, you know, will likely get worse over time. It's a very serious condition. So when I read that part, I said, oh, that's not good. That's not good. So as far as him wrestling again in a WWE ring, you know, it's not over till it's over. You know, the book is not completely closed, I think, but it's not looking too good. He did say getting back in the ring is something he would want to do, but under the right circumstances, that may not be his decision to make. Time will tell. He said the injury occurred on the buckle bomb, both buckle bombs, the first one and then the one where his legs gave out after. The first one was like a whiplash, and the second one he said was even worse. He took responsibility for what happened. Rollins was a wreck after the match. He popped his head into the ambulance. He apologized. Sting told him, listen, it's not your fault. And he gave Rollins the highest praise. I mean, he gave this guy the biggest endorsement you could possibly get. He said after 30 years working with some of the biggest names in the business, he said Seth Rollins has got to be the best that he has ever worked with. And on the surface, it may sound like bullshit. He's just saying that. But when you really think about the people and the caliber of talent that he's worked with. I mean, you could say Ric Flair, but I've said it before on this podcast. In fact, it wasn't very many weeks ago on the show when everybody in the world, it felt like, was crapping on this guy. And I've crapped on Rollins too for, you know, the long promos. But I mean, again, that's not completely his fault. They send him out there for 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes to fill time, and it gets boring after a while. But as a performer, I said this a few weeks ago, I'm not just saying it now because Sting said it, I said he's probably the best in that entire company. He is, if anything, not overrated. I mean, he's overexposed, but he's underrated, I think, if anything, because people are so tired of seeing Seth Rollins in every single segment that they just kind of cast him off and they say, oh, I'm tired of seeing this guy. And yeah, I can understand that feeling to a degree, but let's not forget the fact that in the ring, when he's on his A game, which is pretty much all the time, he is the best they have. I mean, you know, name me somebody who's better overall as a performer than him right now in WWE. And so, yeah, when I said, if anything, he's underrated, that's really what I'm referring to. So for Sting to make that kind of comment, I mean, he's wrestled a lot of people, but it really isn't that much of a stretch to think that Rollins may well be, you know, one of the best he's ever been in the ring with. And I think he probably honestly believes that. Because he could do things that, you know, not very many other people can do. And the fact is, even though Dolph Ziggler likes to play dress-up like him, I think the closest thing to a Shawn Michaels in the ring that we have right now is Seth Rollins. And I'm sure if Sting was ever in the ring with Shawn Michaels, he'd say the same thing, that Shawn Michaels was the best he's ever been in the ring with. So it really isn't that much of a stretch to think that. But accidents happen. You know, the Cena thing, when Rollins kneed him in the face, it was a freak accident that could have happened to anybody. It's not as though he has a history of breaking people's noses or breaking people's faces with his knee or being clumsy or being unsafe to work with. I still don't know why Sting had to take a second buckle bomb in that match after taking the first one. I even tweeted it out that night after the injury happened. I said, I don't understand why he had to take the same move twice. You're tempting fate. The fact that this 56-year-old guy, you would launch him into the corner the first time, when he first got hurt, that Sting said he got, you know, kind of a whiplash effect that first time. And when he took it the second time, he was thinking in his head, well, surely the same thing won't happen. Not only did it happened worse. I don't understand. I don't understand whose idea that was, or I don't know. I don't know, but that was stupid. He should not have taken that move a second time, let alone a first time. Sting doesn't hold him responsible, and obviously neither does WWE, seeing as how he gave John Cena the exact same move the next night on Raw. So for the people saying, well, does this mean Rollins has heat, and is he unsafe to work with? Look, if he ends up being like an Ahmed Johnson, where he's hurting himself, he's hurting another 2, 3, 4 people, and people are bitching about him in the back, then we can talk about him being, you know, unsafe in the ring. I've never heard that. I don't believe that. I don't believe he has any heat. If he did, like I said, you would not see him giving John Cena, the crown prince of the company, the same moves the very next night on Raw. The column I did for TJR, wrestling.net this week, was on Sting. It was kind of like a thank you to Sting. Just a column on how, if he never comes back again, it would be sad. You know, selfishly, I'd love to see him come back, get that kind of closure he deserves. One last match, maybe where he actually wins for a change. But he doesn't have anything left to prove. He doesn't have to come back. He doesn't have to wrestle another match a day in his life. He's had a very charmed career for himself, from WCW through TNA and now in WWE, even despite all the losing. It's gotten a pretty good response. If you want to go back and check that out, it's up on tjrwrestling.com, or .net, I'm sorry. It went up about midweek, so you could check out the column and my past columns there. I've got a couple of other ones up. The Brock Lesnar Go to Hell Tour. This is the other big news that broke in a commercial. No pomp and circumstance or Paul Heyman promo, just a random commercial they aired on the Night of Champions pay-per-view, narrated by Paul Heyman, voiced over by Paul Heyman, about this Go to Hell Tour that they've put together. It starts with Lesnar against Big Show at Madison Square Garden, which is actually next weekend. Then he'll be a guest of Steve Austin on the next Live Austin podcast on the network on Monday, October 19th, which is a Raw show, by the way, that they're loading up with legends now because their ratings are in the shitter and they're in panic mode. I mean, they won't admit that, but let's be honest. I mean, their ratings have never been lower, and all of a sudden they announce a show. Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker will be there because they're headlining the pay-per-view that Sunday in a Hell in a Cell match. And so, of course, they'll be on the go-home show. But also on that Raw show, Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels, and Stone Cold Steve Austin, who will be there anyway backstage for the podcast. But usually Austin doesn't actually appear in the ring on the show. I can't even remember the last time Austin appeared on Raw Live before the crowd. So that tells you right there that they really want to load this thing up. They are going with Lesnar and Undertaker and Hell in a Cell. Before I get into that, let me just mention the Austin thing. Because people all of a sudden, Brock Lesnar is going to be in the same room with Steve Austin, and we remember what happened in the last podcast that he did with Paul Heyman in the tease for a Texas Death Match. And then there were the stories that Vince was very upset because Vince did not, have any expectation of putting that match together. And so why are you promoting a match or even teasing a match that you can't possibly top? There is no match that they can come up with for WrestleMania next year that would be as big with who they have on the current roster and the legends and everything, as Austin versus Lesnar. I can't think of one. I don't think Rock versus Lesnar is as big, or Rock versus Triple H, if that's the match they do go with, which is rumored to be the plan. Undertaker against virtually anyone, even Sting. I mean, that would be a marquee match. I don't see it happening, especially now. But there is no bigger match, I think, that they could put together in Texas for WrestleMania than Austin coming back for the first time in, 13 years against Brock Lesnar? So I can understand why Vince would be like, hey, keep your mouth shut. Don't talk about this because we can't possibly top that. But people, again, got the rumor mill going when they announced that Brock was going to be on his podcast. Ooh, maybe they're going to shoot the angle to set up for a match at WrestleMania. And Austin's been pretty adamant. I mean, more now than ever before. In the past, he was always like, you know, if I wanted to come back, I could. I could get another 2-year run if I wanted to. And never say never if the creative is right, if the money is right. You know, look, if they come to Austin with this great creative plan and they say, we're going to pay you $5 million, I'm willing to bet he would probably change his tune. But I don't see them making that kind of offer. And so he's been pretty adamant. I am not going to wrestle again. My time has come and gone. I'm very busy, and it's been far too long, and that's the end of it. And so he must have gotten pissed off at something, or just people tweeting him, hey, you're going to wrestle Lesnar at Mania, and he came out and he said, to shut the rumor mill down, I am not going to be, or at least not wrestling, at WrestleMania next year. He said, bullshit reports. He seemed pretty pissed off about it. So I think it's pretty safe to say, not that I thought it would happen anyway, but just to shut down the people who were still thinking it might happen, Austin is not wrestling at WrestleMania next year. And if he's not wrestling at WrestleMania next year, he is never wrestling again. Period. End of story. So there is not going to be a match with Brock. It is just a podcast, nothing more. Although they may shoot some kind of angle to set up an opponent for Brock at Mania next year. You know, they are in Dallas that night for Raw, and Dallas is the home of WrestleMania, so you never know. But it won't be with Austin. But they are doing Lesnar-Undertaker at Hell in a Cell next month. You may recall many weeks ago, I pitched the idea of them doing a Hell in a Cell match in October at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view and not waiting until WrestleMania, which had been the plan, and for whatever reason, Vince McMahon has changed his mind. He says, we're not doing it at Mania, we're doing it in October. What his reasons are, nobody seems to know. Only Vince knows. But I am very happy to see it, because it makes sense. How many years have we had Hell in a Cell pay-per-views? And you could argue, okay, last year we had Rollins and Ambrose. Two guys that were brothers, and Rollins turned on him, and they had what was actually a pretty damn good lumberjack match at SummerSlam. It was a feud that had built for months. It was a blood feud, but without the blood. That was an appropriate main event. Shitty finish, but an appropriate Hell in a Cell match last year. But that's it's very rare with these Hell in a Cell pay-per-views that they give you a main event that's truly worthy of the stipulation. A lot of times it's October, so we have to have a Hell in a Cell match. And so this is one example of a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view with a main event that actually fits the bill. And I'm very happy that they're not waiting until Mania next year to stretch this out, and they'll climax the feud. This is they're calling it their final ever encounter, so it's not like they're going to have a fourth match at Mania next year. This is it. This is the end of the road for Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, so I'm glad they went with that idea. And in my Sound Off Extra review on YouTube that I did last Monday, I also talked a little bit about what that could mean for each guy at WrestleMania next year in terms of a new opponent, and I wondered if maybe they don't have Brock Lesnar win the Royal Rumble, even as a surprise entrant. I don't even know that he needs to be a surprise entrant. In fact, you know what? I wouldn't have him as a surprise. I would want people to know that this guy's going to be in the Rumble because, and I said this in the YouTube video, he is probably the one guy, short of Daniel Bryan himself, and who the hell even knows if Bryan is going to come back. But he's probably the one guy, Bryan aside, who you could put in that match and build around the idea that he might win and not have the fans crap all over your Royal Rumble for the third straight year, which I think, you know, as a fan, I love the Rumble, and that's even a concern of mine. You know, I don't want to see the people hijack this fucking match every single year. And Brock may be that one guy. If people think he's going to win and they want to see him win, they actually won't hijack the match, and they'll be into it, and they'll be happy when he wins. Right? So it kind of makes sense if that's the direction they want to go in, and then it, you know, leads to a championship match with whoever the champion is, whether it's still Rollins, if it's somebody else, at WrestleMania. Brock challenging for the title. That's what I would do, because there's no other logical opponent for him that I could think of at the moment that I would want to see him in the ring with. I would rather see him win the Rumble, have a Rumble winner that's worthy, and put him back in the championship picture. And as far as The Undertaker is concerned, I've seen a lot of reports online this week. John Cena's a rumored opponent. It was reported in somewhere, maybe one of the newsletters, The Observer, whatever. Well, before any of that bullshit even came out, on Monday I did my YouTube video. And in that video, I pitched that very idea. have The Undertaker wrestle John Cena at WrestleMania next year. Not even so much pitching it as much as I thought that would probably end up being the plan, even if they are a couple of years late on doing that match, because without the streak, it won't quite have the oomph that it would have had. But that would still be a big match, and it's been years and years and years since we've seen John Cena and The Undertaker in a one-on-one match. So remember that. As we get closer to Mania season, I'm going to call it right now, my predictions, that Lesnar is in the Rumble and wins it, and Undertaker wrestles John Cena. Monday Night Raw this past week was live from Laredo, Texas. I took one of those WWE fan council surveys this week. They have this thing called the Fan Council. Don't ask me how to even sign up. I honestly don't even remember how I got signed up for it, but I did. And so periodically I will get an email with a link to take a survey. They are obviously contracted with some kind of marketing, third-party marketing company that does these surveys for them. And they're very interesting, and many times I will post screenshots of some of the more interesting questions on my Twitter page. So sometimes it may be, hey, which DVD would you buy if we did? And then they give you a whole list of DVD ideas. It could be a DVD on Paul Heyman, which they did. A DVD on Eric Bischoff, which they're actually working on now for next year. It could be a War Games DVD or this, you know, or what kind of network special would you like to see? But I got a survey this week that had a very interesting question and a very appropriate question coming off the heels of some of these recent Raw shows that we've had. It wanted to know how appealing the following brands are. And these questions, and this was not the only question, they were basically questions about antacids and drugs for upset stomach. They're asking how appealing are brands like Tums and Rolaids and Pepto-Bismol and Alka-Seltzer. And all I could think is they are clearly aware of how Raw makes people feel most weeks. I could have downed an entire bottle of Mylanta after watching that show 2 weeks ago, and it probably still wouldn't have worked. And it would have left a sour taste in my mouth, kind of like this show does. But I saw that question. I'm answering other questions before this, and I'm going along, and all of a sudden, boom, they hit me with this question, Tums and Pepto-Bismol. I'm like, they really understand me. They really do understand their fan base. So, even though it was the Raw coming off a pay-per-view, you would think it would do better. Raw topped its awful rating from 2 weeks ago with its lowest non-holiday number since 1997. Congratulations. 3.34 million viewers, down from 3.39 million viewers the week before. And that awful number, 3.37 million before that. Worse, they lost audience each of the 3 hours. So they started at this level, they went down, and they went down again. And wouldn't you know, it happened coming out of a show where the two people positioned strongest when it was over were Kane and The Big Show. I guess it only makes sense that Raw's numbers would be at 1997 levels, seeing as how they're still relying on stars from 1997. This was the Night of Rematches edition of Raw, coming off Night of Champions. It opened with the Wyatt family out for a promo that was interrupted by Roman Reigns. Anything is better than a 15-minute Seth Rollins promo gloating about his win over Sting, so I was fine with this. Roman said he wanted Bray one-on-one. They don't even need a referee. They fought for a little bit. Harper and Strowman, of course, ran in. Dean Ambrose ran out. Then Randy Orton returned to even the odds, which begs the question, why didn't they just make Randy Orton the third man at the pay-per-view? I'm not saying I wanted him to be. It just, if he was going to come back the next night, then, you know what I mean? Why even bring back Jericho? There was no Chris Jericho on this show, and no indication that he would be back, which renders what they did at Night of Champions pretty much meaningless. I mean, I guess they just wanted a name in there who could make Braun Strowman look strong and, you know, do the job for him. If they had no intention, though, following up on the Jericho stuff, he should not have been the third guy. It just comes off as a total waste looking back on it now. Especially since it looks like they're going to just end up doing what would have been that six-man tag anyway, probably at Hell in a Cell with Orton and Ambrose and Reigns against the Wyatts. So, around and around we go. It just seems like they wanted to delay things a little bit for no real reason. Seth Rollins walked into the authority's office and ran into Corporate Kane. He was happy to be back at work as the director of operations and was acting as if he had no idea what had happened the night before when Kane destroyed Seth Rollins to end the show. Then later in the show, when Triple H and Stephanie asked Kane to give back his mask, he claimed he had no idea where it is. I don't know what you're talking about. So indeed, they are doing the old Joseph Park angle from TNA. I used to love the Joseph Park character. I was a huge Park Mark. Corporate Kane, not so much. He told Seth that he'd be facing John Cena in a rematch for the U.S. title in the main event. Boy, you know, there was a time on this podcast where I said I looked forward to the day that John Cena had a fresh feud with somebody like Seth Rollins. Now I look forward to the day that John Cena has a fresh feud with anybody but Seth Rollins. And the fact that ratings went down as the show went on leading into this match proves that I am not the only one who feels that way. I feel like I've seen this match a thousand times, right? And you know what? When you count the house shows, they may well have wrestled a thousand times. I know it hasn't literally been a thousand times on TV, but it feels like it. It's like WWE is like a teenage boy that discovers masturbation for the first time. Right? They do it once. It feels good. So they do it again. And again and again and again. All in one shot. And then they wonder, how come it's not working anymore? They have the self-control of a horny teenager. They do the same thing over and over and over and over again. Watch me, they'll do it again. They'll do that match again. And they'll expect a different result in the ratings. You know what the definition of that is? Insanity. I'm just saying. Neville and the Lucha Dragons beat Stardust and LOL. After Stardust and LOL beat Neville and the Lucha Dragons on the kickoff show the night before. So good old even-Steven booking where absolutely nobody gets over. I think part of the reason people are not at all enamored with this show right now is because it feels like nothing ever changes. It kind of goes to what I was just saying about doing things over and over and over and over again. Everyone is right where they're always going to be. Some guys belong there, but others don't. I mean, it's been almost 20 years and Kane and Big Show were still headlining. I have no problem with them wrestling. Especially, look at Kane. Kane's a freak of nature. Kane's another one who I think is underrated. Overexposed, but underrated. But at his age, for him to be doing the things he's doing, and also when they put him in some of those skits, you know, Kane can shine. I mean, Kane is actually quite good when they give him the right material to be good. He can deliver. So that's not the problem I have. The issue is you have these two guys who are still in positions where they are headlining after 20 years. It feels like nothing ever changes. And this even-Steven bullshit is a big part of why. Take Cody Rhodes. Let's use Cody Rhodes as an example. He's doing the Stardust thing now, and that's cool. He's having fun with it. It means something on a sentimental level to him. He's talked about it. Great, fine. I have no problem with it. As Stardust or Cody or whatever, there have been different chances for them to try to break this guy out of the pack over the years, going back to the Legacy days. And it's frustrating to watch. You know, I still remember that episode of Raw where Dusty Rhodes was the guest host. This was very early in the days when they started the guest hosting stuff. He may have been like the second or third guest host they ever had. And I think he booked a WWE title match between Cody and Randy Orton, both of whom were part of Legacy at the time. And John Cena was out there. He was probably the guest referee or something. And Dusty ended up turning on Cena. And all the members of Legacy beat down John Cena. Then Randy Orton turned on Dusty and gave him an RKO because that's what Randy Orton does, right? He's a snake. And there's the shot of Cody Rhodes, who was the third wheel in that group at the time. I mean, let's be honest. DiBiase was the one everybody thought would go on to become a big star first. Didn't quite work out that way. But the shot of Cody just fuming mad, he never put his hands on Orton. He wanted to. And the fans wanted him to, but he just stood there. He was steaming. He was angry. And they actually went off the air with the crowd chanting, "Cody, Cody, Cody." There was a chance way back then for them to do something to make Cody Rhodes a star. and they didn't do it. It's almost like, if you think back to Evolution, right? They had big plans for Randy Orton. Randy Orton was going to be just like the next big superstar. This guy is young, and he's so talented. He's great. And Batista got over. So it's not that Orton didn't end up becoming a big star, but they changed plans, right? The WrestleMania 21 main event originally was going to be Triple H against Randy Orton. That's what they were building to. And they blew that off early in favor of pushing Dave Batista to the moon. It wasn't like they had this grand plan where Evolution was going to get Batista over as the next big star. It just happened, right? It happened naturally. The fans took to the guy. They were telling this great story, a very slow burn between Triple H and Batista before Batista officially split. It was great. They could see what was going on, and they went with the other guy. And I almost wish they would have done that with Legacy. Whatever plans they may have had for DiBiase, that was the moment they should have looked in the mirror and said, you know what? There may be something here. Maybe we ought to go with the other guy. And they didn't do that. And that's what I thought that group was designed to help do, right? Get the newer guys over. Randy Orton was already over. But you know who came out of Legacy an even bigger star when it was all said and done? The one guy who actually did become an even bigger star when that group was over? Wasn't Ted DiBiase. Wasn't Cody Rhodes. It was Randy Orton, who had already won probably 7 or 8 world titles by that point. He was super over when Legacy was done and ran its course. And the fans turned him babyface. But that's just one example. You know, when I think of Cody, that's the first thing I think of. That was the first time I personally looked at Cody and said to myself, hey, maybe this guy can be, you know, a bigger star than I thought maybe he would be. And it's frustrating when you see stuff like that. That's one example. We've seen it with so many guys, with Cesaro. I mean, the list goes on and on. Wade Barrett. For God's sakes, this guy led an invasion of the company and beat John Cena in a pay-per-view. It wasn't a main event, I don't think, but he beat him on pay-per-view. And boy, I bet we could look back on matches where John Cena has lost clean to the new guy on pay-per-view, and it ends up not meaning a whole hell of a lot. You know, we saw that with Kevin Owens a few months ago, and you think, boy, this guy's on an upward trajectory here. He's going to be a big deal. And it wasn't very long after that Wade Barrett was just reduced to fucking nothing. I mean, a couple months later, he was leading the Core faction on SmackDown. Fucking Core. What are they, a fucking apple? I mean, come on. So we can just go down the list, example after example after example, and you wonder why people just don't care. They don't care. How could you get behind anybody on that show? If you pay attention to their track record with people, why would you ever invest your time in wanting to see, hey, I like that guy. I'm going to watch the show and watch every segment and every match that he's in because this guy's the next big thing. I like this guy. He's going places. No, he's not. No, he's not. You know where he's going? He's going right down the shitter. That's where he's going. Because how could anybody get behind people on this show? Look at Cody's old partner, Damian Sandow. What the hell happened with this guy? You can't tell me that he didn't have people who were rooting for him, that he didn't have people out there who were Damian Sandow fans who would have loved to see this guy get a little bit of a push. Not even a world championship push, just a little bit of a push. You got 2 mid-card titles. Has he ever challenged for one of them? Have we ever seen Damian Sandow challenge for the U.S. or Intercontinental title? It may have happened, but if it did, it was a long-ass time ago because I sure as hell don't remember. You want to know what I remember? What I remember is when all the comedy bullshit was done. This was a few months ago. And they actually gave him a microphone. I was shocked. They gave this guy a mic in the middle of Monday Night Raw. Not Superstars or Main Event. They gave him a mic and airtime on Monday Night Raw. And he came out as himself. As Damian Sandow. And he cut what I thought was a hell of a promo. And he had the people behind him. And I think the first thing that happened was they sent Axelmania, brother. They sent him out there, and it ended up turning into a comedy thing. I think maybe he laid out Axel. Of course, what ended up happening is they put the two of them together as the Mega Powers. They had, you know, Macho Mandow, which actually was, I have to say, I have to give credit, one of our listeners pitched that idea weeks and weeks and weeks before WWE ran with it. So credit to that person for having the foresight to come up with that. I laughed at it, too. I thought it was a funny idea. But, you know, what isn't funny is the fact that they gave Sandow that time. I thought he knocked it out of the park, and I thought, again, they had a real chance. They had a real chance to try to do something with him and make him anything but a joke. Because he wasn't a gimmick. He didn't walk out dressed like Macho Man or with the robe doing cartwheels. He just came out as himself. He spoke from the heart. And the people applauded and they gave him an ovation. And I thought, wow, this could be the start of something special. What happened after that? What happened after that? Nothing. Not a fucking thing happened after that. Then you have Adam Rose, right, coming out of that ESPN special. Another guy. Maybe you're not going to make millions off this guy. But you have so many bodies that are just kind of floating around. You know, like these apparitions. They're just floating around. Sometimes you see them, but you're not quite sure that they exist. Right? They're like ghosts. And they float from city to city. But you have this guy, and you give him airtime on ESPN. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. Right? I mean, if you're just going to feature somebody on ESPN for the hell of it and not do anything with them, you may as well put Zack Ryder on the fucking ESPN special. But no, they had Adam Rose, again, out of character, as himself. And when it was over, I'm not the only one who felt this way. I wanted to see this guy succeed. I wanted to see this guy win the fucking world title, even though I knew that was never going to happen. But that's how I felt. ESPN did a better job in those 60 minutes of getting Adam Rose over than WWE has done in years. And you thought to yourself, maybe now they will do something with him. They'll drop the stupid gimmick, let him be himself, send him out there and capitalize off of this publicity that he got. Right? You could air some of the clips from the ESPN special on Raw for the people who may not have seen it. Nothing. They did nothing with him. Now they've repackaged him into another gimmick that will fail. And it's this cycle of rinse, repeat. And that contributes to the feeling of staleness and sameness that we get on this show, which is why you see the numbers where they are. I mean, it's only part of it, but it's a fairly big part of it, I think. What they've done to the majority of their roster is criminal. Because it's not like they don't have the talent. You can't sit here and say the roster back in the Attitude Era was so much more talented and so much better than the guys are now. Really? Is that really the case? Because I don't know that that's the case. The guys they have now, they're pretty freaking talented. It's just a matter of what you do with them. They don't run the show. They can't just walk out there and grab the mic out of fucking Lillian Garcia's hand and start cutting a promo. I'm sure some of them would love to do that. But can't exactly do that. Not if you want to stay gainfully employed. So they sit in the back and they wait. It's like when you go to the fucking deli counter and you grab a ticket and you're waiting for your turn so you can order a fucking pound of tuna salad for yourself. These guys are sitting in the back waiting for their number to be called. And it's like waiting in line behind the same four or five people. And when those four or five people have their turn, instead of it being your turn, it goes right back to those same four or five people. Nothing ever changes. The line never moves. And that's sad. And I feel bad for those guys. I feel bad for me. I feel bad for myself as a fan. The fans should feel sorry for themselves. Because it's not their fault either. Anyway. I didn't mean to go on a rant like that, but I guess I did. I said my piece. Sin Cara slipped in this match, trying to do a springboard off the ropes. He fell flat on his face. Then later he did a tope out of the ring onto Victor and landed face first on the edge of the announce. I shouldn't laugh, but he landed face first on the announce table. It looked like he knocked himself out. This fucking guy. I don't know. He was channeling the old spirit of Sin Cara on the show. Ryback pinned Bo Dallas with Kevin Owens on commentary. Owens attacked him after the match. Ryback fought back, and Kevin Owens fled with his Intercontinental title. They had Cesaro pin Bo Dallas on SmackDown this week. He needed a roll-up to do it. He needed a roll-up to beat Bo Dallas. But he won, right? I guess a win is a win. By the way, on his personal Twitter, we're just talking about Cody Rhodes. Cody said that he will be pissed if Brock Lesnar against Cesaro does not happen in the next few years. Nice to see other people finally coming around to the idea. At this rate, though, I would think that Cody is going to be awfully pissed in a few years. I'm sorry to say, but I think that will be the case. Ric Flair was out next to introduce his daughter as the new Divas Champion. He called watching her win the title at Night of Champions the greatest moment of his life. And this would have been the perfect time for him and for her to trash the whole Divas label and that god-awful butterfly belt and hand her his original big gold world title belt to use as the new women's championship. Now, I know some of you may think that idea is sacrilege. There was a whole thread on this on our Facebook page. But I said it there and I'll say it here. If you want real change, you've got to think big. That could be Charlotte's gimmick. She's not a diva. You know, like her father was the greatest wrestler in the world at one time, she's the greatest women's wrestler in the world. And only she uses big gold until she loses it. Then they can introduce their new women's belt, their new women's design for the championship, you know, whatever it looks like. I'm not advocating that they just use big gold permanently as the new women's belt. It's Charlotte's gimmick. You're not going to see Nikki Bella or Eva Marie holding the big gold belt. I agree, that would be sacrilege. But I do think it would add an element of prestige that's always been missing from the Divas division. You know, again, when I first mentioned this idea, I think it was half joking on the show like a week or two ago. But the more I thought about it, it was only half joking. It was not a complete and total joke. There was some legitimacy to me making that statement. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, you know what? This could work. This could work. It's only a small part. It's not like by changing the belt, all of a sudden the Divas division is going to be this great thing and everybody's going to care about it. It's kind of like people bitched about the spinner belt for years. And I had no use for it either. I hated the spinner belt. Even when it stopped spinning, I thought it was stupid. It looked too gaudy. I didn't like it. It didn't look like a world championship to me. But it was never this idea that even when WWE was not doing well, you know, they went through these periods over the years, you know, during the Cena era where the product just really was not that exciting. And it really wasn't that fun. But it wasn't a case where, well, if John Cena would just get rid of that goddamn belt and they would bring back the Winged Eagle or they would bring back the Undisputed belt or just create a new belt, everything is going to be great. The belt is a very small part of it. But I think it's even more of a problem with the Divas because there is this perception of the Divas division that they just absolutely have to get rid of. Okay, they have to just completely reinvent the whole thing. And that's part of it. You know, plus look, the big gold belt, hey, it's a beautiful belt. And it's not a fucking pink monstrosity. You've got Ric Flair out there bawling his eyes out, talking about how Charlotte winning the title was the greatest night of his life. Whether he actually believes that or not, that's what he said. It would not be much of a stretch to see this guy out there handing the big gold belt that is most associated with him, that he created, handing it over to his daughter and telling her to make him proud. I mean, a few people lost their minds on Facebook when I proposed this. And when I asked why, one of the reasons was that the Divas division means nothing and nobody will care. Therefore, it would somehow tarnish the prestige of the belt. As if WWE didn't do enough of that to the World Heavyweight title themselves over the last 5 years. Lest we forget Jack Swagger as World Heavyweight Champion for 2 months, or the Great Khali as World Heavyweight Champion, or all the times on Raw where they would have a world title match in the second segment on the show like it was an afterthought. You mean to tell me that Ric Flair bestowing the title on his daughter and leading an overhaul of the women's division is somehow more disrespectful to that title than what WWE did to it? Give me a break. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Nobody's going to care anyway, so let's not do it. Hey, let's beat Cesaro like a drum week after week, and then when we decide to put him in a main event on TV and it draws a bad rating, we could turn around and say, see? Told you he wouldn't draw. You're going to have to come up with a better excuse than that. I'm not buying it. I still think it's a worthwhile idea, at least to think about. So out came Charlotte, Paige, and Becky, PCB. Charlotte and her dad had a contest, apparently, to see who could keep from crying first. I'll give you three guesses who lost that one. Charlotte had nice things to say about her PCB sisters, including Paige, who she said was the first ever NXT Women's Champion, which is true. Paige had heard enough of all this mushy crap. She grabbed the mic away from her, commenced the Paige turn, She said that she was the one who made all of this possible. She told Charlotte, "You won the title. So what? I won it on my first day." And this was hilarious because Charlotte is all up in Paige's face now. She's getting hot. She's getting angry. Not 60 seconds earlier, she was practically in tears, heaping praise on... try to say that five times fast. Praise on Paige. Which just goes to show you, though, the reason I mention that is it just goes to show you how vicious girls can be to each other, right? That, I'm watching this going to myself, wait a minute. Charlotte looks fucking angry here, and she's getting up in Paige's face like, who are you? You're this and that. And I'm like, 60 seconds ago, she was like your best friend in the world. You couldn't stop saying good things about her. But all of a sudden, boom, just on a dime, it's like she turned. I'm telling you, man, women, much worse than men. You got the impression that Charlotte really was being patronizing in her speech and actually did not mean a damn word that she was saying about Paige, which I guess makes Paige, I don't know if that makes Paige the babyface or not, but apparently she was telling the truth. So Paige said Nikki's going to get her rematch, she'll take the title back, and the Divas division is going to go right back to where it was. There is no Divas revolution, she said. Charlotte is simply a placeholder. She said Becky would never be Divas champion because she's the least relevant of all of them. Which is actually kind of true. She said Team Bad is all flash and no substance. Lana and Summer Rae are too busy worrying about who they want to climb onto next rather than the Divas division. Hell, up until now, they were the only two Divas on the roster with an actual storyline, and they're not even wrestling. So I don't know what that says about this whole Divas Revolution movement. She mentioned Natty and wondered if Natty even worked for the company anymore. She hasn't been seen. And then she brought up the Bellas and said, we all know the real reason how they got to where they are. And surprisingly, that line did not get the kind of reaction I thought it would. I also found it funny, this idea that Brie Mode got to where she is because she's married to Daniel Bryan. As though Daniel Bryan has any kind of real pull or influence in that company. That was just fucking hilarious to me. Come on, Nikki, on the other hand. I think that's pretty obvious. She turned her venom, Paige did, back to Charlotte, said she wouldn't even be where she is right now if it wasn't for her old man. And Becky had to hold Charlotte back at this point. Then Paige wooed and walked out. This was their attempt to resurrect the pipe bomb. And while it was not nearly as good as AJ Lee roasting the Divas division a couple of years ago, I thought this was real good. What helps it is that Paige is such a... I wrote this on Twitter. She's such a natural brat. It's the perfect role for her. She's so much better as a heel. The problem is that she got mostly cheers from the audience, which was not the intended reaction, I'm sure. Not with Ric Flair standing in the ring with his daughter. But ask yourself, why did this get cheers? Because everything she said is true. Becky is the third wheel of the group. The perception of the Bellas is that they got to where they are because of who they stay on top of under the sheets, at least in Nikki's case. Charlotte did get a fast track to the main roster because of who her daddy is. I don't care how good she may be in the ring. Paige said that there is no Divas Revolution, and she's right. And the people know that. So they cheered, because it's all true. The best heels always have at least an element of truth to what they're saying. I think of Chris Jericho in 2008. What made him such a great heel, and what made that whole thing work so well, is that he was right. Shawn Michaels was a lying scumbag. He faked the knee injury to beat Batista, and then he lied about it, and Jericho knew it, and was appalled that the fans continued to cheer for this guy despite all of that. So he turned on him, and all the hypocrite fans booed Jericho, and not Shawn Michaels. Now, the only difference here is that they cheered Paige. We'll see what happens when they're in a different city this week, but I'm glad they did the turn. It wasn't exactly how I pitched it, but they did it, and it had to be done. Come on, Nikki, Brie Mode, and Alicia Fox came out with Nikki doing a poor job of selling the fact that she lost her Divas title 24 hours earlier. This was very John Cena-esque. She's learning well from her boyfriend, who used to routinely lose championships and then come out on TV the next night smiling like nothing ever happened. You would think that this woman would be sad or would be angry, and she was neither one of those things. Because she already broke the record, right, as the longest reigning champion. And she knows that she gets a rematch anyway. She said Charlotte would be wrestling Brie tonight. They had a match. Charlotte won with the figure eight. Not much to it. Sheamus pinned Mark Henry after a second brogue kick, since the first one missed so badly they had to redo the spot. It's just a nothing match. Henry is the world's strongest jobber these days. I still say a better role for him would be backstage enforcer, that you lock in a room with everybody who hops the barricade. Paige ran into Natalya backstage, who has not been on TV in months. Natty told her that what she said out there was unprofessional, and that the only one standing in Paige's way was Paige. It was cool to see Natty back on TV. If you remember a few weeks ago when I went on my rant about the Divas Revolution nonsense, I pitched an idea for Natty to be part of it, kind of this story of redemption as somebody who's been cast aside, on the outside looking in, maybe looked at as being past her prime. People like Natty. They empathize with her. They want to see her succeed. They know what, and part of it also is they know what happened with Tyson, so there's also kind of a little bit of sympathy there. But, you know, they see her on Total Divas or whatever, and they can empathize with how she probably feels being left out. And they want to see her succeed, and it's her goal, right? The story would be that it's her goal to once again win back the Divas Championship. And she works her way up to a title match with Charlotte. Right, that was kind of the idea that I pitched a couple of weeks ago. I have no idea if that's their plan. I'm guessing not. I somehow doubt that very seriously. But in her first match back, she got pinned by Naomi's ass in a very short match. So, I don't know. You know, it's still early. I don't want to judge what they may be doing yet, because they could do that story, and maybe the idea is that she's going to lose her first few matches before she picks it up. But then again, this is the same company that gave this woman a farting gimmick. So, excuse me if I don't have a whole lot of optimism. The New Day came out. Xavier Woods has a piece of table in his hand as they come out. He said that it had to be removed from his ass the night before after the Dudleys put him through a table. Big E said they were going to build a wall around Dudleyville to protect its citizens and their furniture. I saw the New Day on that table for three show on the network. I don't know how anybody could dislike these guys. I think they're just great, and I hope they never break up and they have success for the next 1,000 years. They teamed with Rusev against the Dudleys and Dolph Ziggler. At one point, Xavier Woods, when Rusev was on offense, he played Rusev's theme song on the trombone. It was quite glorious. Dolph super kicked Woods off the apron later in the match. His trombone went flying. Summer Rae was standing there. She caught it. And Rusev then caught Ziggler with a kick for the pin. More even Steven booking, right? Dolph beat Rusev the night before, so Rusev gets his win back the very next night. And we are right back to where we were before with these two guys. Nothing ever changes. Somehow, we had a pay-per-view and a Raw show, and it feels like we made no progress in this storyline from the week before. We're just jogging in quicksand here. The Big Show beat Cesaro with a knockout punch, much the same way he did on SmackDown the week before. Funny how one of the very few people they don't use even Steven booking with is The Big Show. He beats you, and he beats you again. Cesaro suplexed Big Show into the ring from the apron. That was the big spot of the match. He was, you know, his back was bothering him, but he muscled the Big Show over for a suplex, which would have been far more impressive had Big Show not gotten right back up and knocked him out cold. Hashtag midcard for life. Big Show then cut a promo on Brock Lesnar to hype their match coming up at Madison Square Garden. It was actually a really good promo. He even brought up handing Brock his first loss at MSG back at Survivor Series in 2002. And I don't fault them for wanting to make Big Show look strong heading into the match. They should. They absolutely should. Why do it with Cesaro? Why? Why? Where's Miz? Wasn't that supposed to be the feud anyway, Big Show and Miz? Is it wrong that I want to see them drop a full ratings point next week just to watch Vince's head explode like that guy from Scanners? I don't want to see them drop 0.2 or 0.3. I want to see one full ratings point off. And then I want to put a camera in Vince's office. I want to make a bag of popcorn, and I want to sit here and stream it on my computer. That's what I want to see. Why? Why do you have to use this? This guy was building momentum. Ah, fuck it. Who cares? John Cena and Seth Rollins for the United States Championship. Here's a match we've never seen before. Second straight night. No springboard stunner for John Cena, so that's a plus. Rollins busted out a beautiful frog splash late in the match. John Cena immediately no-sold it, turned it into an AA for the pin. I absolutely hated that finish. I hated, hated, hated that finish. Why is your WWE World Heavyweight Champion being repeatedly pinned by John Cena? If they insist on doing that, put the fucking title on John Cena. If they insist on doing that, just put the championship on him and be done with it. Pisses me the fuck off every time they do that. I don't care. People will say, well, they're telling a story. Seth Rollins is losing to everybody. He lost to Dean Ambrose, I think, on another fucking distraction roll-up on SmackDown. Oh, that's great. That's a great way to book your world champion. That he loses every single match. I mean, he beat Sting, because Sting's an even bigger fucking loser. Couldn't even beat Seth Rollins, who loses to everybody else, and had just wrestled a match, and still lost clean. So I don't know what the hell that says about Sting. But, yeah, that's a great way to book your world champion. That's great. That's exactly what people want to see. After the match, Rollins is all alone in the ring. Corporate Kane appears on the Titantron, tells Seth lots of people are gunning for his championship, including some that he could never imagine. At which point, the arena turns red. Out from a hole in the ring comes the Demon Kane, who tries to drag him down to hell with Zack Ryder. Rollins kicked and squirmed and tried to get away, but Kane pulled him down to TNA anyway, and smoke billowed out of the hole as the show went off the air. Lucha Underground is coming back, everybody. Just keep reminding yourself of that. Actually, if any show could make dragging somebody down to hell work in the context of their world and not come off as completely hokey and stupid, it probably is Lucha Underground, to be perfectly honest with you. They could pretty much make almost anything work. A couple of other notes here. During the show on Monday night, I was tweeting with you guys back and forth just to keep myself entertained. And I posted a tweet. I said, if WWE gave you these three choices for a future podcast guest on the Steve Austin podcast on the network, of the three, you can't say all three, but of the three, if you could only pick one, who is the one that you would pick? Who is the one that you would like to see interviewed the most? And the choices I gave were Undertaker, The Rock, or Shane McMahon. I was expecting The Undertaker to pretty much blow the other ones away. And I was shocked to find that the majority of support went to Shane McMahon. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be shocked. I know there is a lot of interest in seeing Shane come back and find out why he left. I guess I just didn't think it would be that lopsided. I didn't add up all the numbers, but it was, you know, Shane number one, Undertaker number two, and The Rock was like a distant number three. I put The Rock in there just because, you know, obviously he's a big name. But just the idea of having Austin interviewing Rock, I think, would be kind of cool. If I had a pick, I would go with Undertaker personally, as long as he's out of character, of course. I just think that could be a fascinating interview, given how few he's ever done. I mean, he's done a few in the past. He did that one with Michael Landsberg in 2002, which is probably the closest thing to a shoot interview he'll ever do. But and you can still find it on YouTube, by the way. It was right before WrestleMania 18. So I would go with Undertaker personally, but you guys were very much in favor of Shane McMahon. And I think it was just the level of response that kind of surprised me. I was not expecting that. Also, they have a few new shows on the network. They have the Table for Three episode with the... I call them divas. They're not divas. They're ex-female wrestlers. Medusa, Ivory, and Molly Holly, who looks better than ever. I mean, I always thought Molly was cute, but she's just stunning now. And it was actually a lot of fun to just listen to them talk about how it used to be, like in the Attitude Era when they were wrestling, and even going back further than that, and Medusa working with Molly in WCW. I thought Molly was kind of drowned out by Ivory. Ivory can be a little overbearing, but Ivory is someone who speaks her mind. And yeah, I appreciate that. What I really appreciated about Ivory was her reaction to this whole Divas label. They basically spent a few minutes, all three of them, or at least Medusa and Ivory did, trashing, not the Divas division, but just that whole label of Diva. And they were mocking it, as anybody who doesn't know anything about wrestling would. If you hear the word Diva, it has a negative connotation. It's not a positive, endearing term. And that's kind of what they were riffing on and making fun of. They're like, we're not divas, we're women's wrestlers. And I was very happy to hear them crapping all over the whole Diva label. So that was pretty good. You can go check that out. That's I think these episodes are about 25 minutes apiece. The one with New Day I mentioned earlier, that was fantastic. And they have a new series hosted by JBL called Legends with JBL. He interviews somebody from wrestling history. His first show was with Eric Bischoff. They divided it into two parts. It's about an hour each. So it runs about 2 hours total in length. It's a pretty exhaustive interview. It's just the two of them sitting, you know, kind of opposite next to each other. And it was fascinating. It was fascinating to listen to. I mean, it's nothing I haven't heard Bischoff talk about before. I don't really think any new ground was broken. So I can't say, oh, I learned so many new things in this interview. Plus, it's Bischoff. But I will say, you know, Bischoff came up pretty well. You know, he, you know, certainly seems to believe everything he's saying, even if certain things may not have been factually correct. You know, to hear him and JBL talking about the Montreal Screwjob and talking about Bret Hart as he didn't want to lose the title because he was in Canada, I guess, you know, he just didn't want... There's so much more that goes into it. It was such a simplistic thing. And, you know, to hear Bischoff talking about what happened that led to WCW's demise and put a lot of the blame on the merger with Time Warner. Again, it's a simplistic point of view. There's a whole host of different things that went into why WCW failed. Bischoff was part of it, but it wasn't, you know, you can't lay all the blame on him. Just like you can't lay all the blame on the merger either. But he did make a very valid point, which I do believe, and I think had a big part, you know, to do with, in the end, the demise of the company, which is that the people there at Turner, other than Ted Turner himself, who always had a soft spot for wrestling, because wrestling is really what saved his superstation back in the early 80s. You know, were it not for that programming, it probably would not have succeeded. And I think he always had an appreciation for wrestling because of it and always had a soft spot for it. Gave him prime time when Bischoff went to him and said, hey, we need prime time to compete. And then Nitro was born. But Bischoff said that the other executives at Turner hated wrestling. They looked down on it. You know, they kind of thumbed their nose at it. It was never, no matter how successful it was and how great the ratings were, it was never something they wanted in their portfolio. They just did not like pro wrestling, and I guess the audience that it brought or whatever. And I think it's a valid point, and I think it's also kind of sad, you know, when you think about it, because as successful as WCW got at one point, just because you've got this preconceived notion about wrestling or its fan base or its trashy entertainment, and so, you know, it could have made them $100 million. And, you know, look, I'm sure they enjoyed the, you know, the success and the money that it brought in. To still think that they look down on wrestling is such a joke. And I don't doubt for a minute that what Bischoff was saying there was correct. It just kind of went to the mentality of the people who worked there. And then they brought in Jamie Kellner as an executive, a programming executive, and he hated wrestling. And so he said, yeah, you're off the air. And so whatever deal Bischoff had put together to buy the company fell apart because his investors said, shit, you lost TV. This thing is worthless. We're pulling out. And that's when Vince McMahon swooped in for a couple of million dollars, picked the bones, and now he's making a ton of money off the corpse of WCW. So good for him, I guess. It was good, though. Check it out if you have some time. Again, it's pretty long. It's two parts, about 2 hours in length. You won't learn a lot of new things if you've ever heard Bischoff do interviews before. But it's still fascinating to watch. I know he's going to have Ron Simmons on as a guest in the future, Road Dogg. It's good. It's good to see them pumping out original content like that. They need to pump out more of that sort of thing for the network. But they also need to get on their game here and get some of the older stuff up to, like, you know, why can't we get episodes of Superstars, Wrestling Challenge, WCW Saturday Night? At least get those archives started. You know, for example, the Coliseum videos. There's no reason why there shouldn't be a section on the network dedicated to those old Coliseum video releases. You know, a lot of them had some really good matches, some rare matches on there. And I feel like this stuff is just sitting around. There's still, yeah, there's a demand for it from a certain segment of the audience. I get it if that kind of stuff doesn't get the kind of numbers that, you know, like Beast in the East and some of these newer specials get. But you're catering to a few different audiences here, and there's still a ton of content that they're holding back on that is frustrating for me as somebody who does pay $9.99 a month and doesn't get it for free. You know, I want to see them pump out original stuff, but I also want to see them get back to uploading the older stuff because they're really behind the eight ball on that, and they got to get on that.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week opened with Eva Marie. What did we do to deserve this? She wrestled Carmella in the rematch that nobody asked for from TakeOver Brooklyn. Carmella seemingly had the match won, and with the camera angle they used, it looked like the referee, this is the same referee who held up the count on that awful botch a few weeks ago when Eva forgot to kick out. Here again he held up the count, but later on they showed a replay, and Eva did in fact get her foot on the bottom rope. You know, for a minute there, I was worried they were copying their second TNA storyline in 1 week. Eva threw Carmella out of the ring. Carmella could not make it back in time, and so Eva won by countout. And I know the refs down there pretty regularly feed instructions to people from the back when the match is over. But here in plain sight, the referee was practically having a conversation with Eva. A one-way conversation. He was telling her to jump up and down and celebrate and act happy. And as soon as he would tell her this, she would start jumping up and down. And I will rarely complain about a hot woman with a large bust jumping up and down. Feel free to do so, but this just looked completely ridiculous. I mean, does the woman really need to be told, hey, jump up and down, hey, you won, look happy? If this woman needs to be fed instructions to look happy after she wins a match, she may have more problems than we thought. Nia Jax is still coming. Tyler Breeze pinned Bull Dempsey with his feet on the ropes. He'll meet Apollo Creed at TakeOver, which almost guarantees another big loss for Tyler Breeze. And I've said it before, Tyler Breeze, always the bridesmaid, never the bride. They really need to make a secondary title for this guy to hold. You know, they went with the Dusty Tag Team Classic instead of the Dream title that I pitched. Call it whatever you want. They need a second belt. I think this guy would benefit from it. Actually, this guy would benefit from a main roster move if people up there actually knew how to use him, but they don't, so I'd be okay with keeping him down at NXT, but he's got to get something going here. Up next was the contract signing for NXT's newest superstar. William Regal introduces Kana under that name, and then as she walks out, her Titantron changes from Kana to Asuka. And she was super excited to be there. She grabbed the microphone, she shouted, "Yay!" And she may have gotten into Mojo Rawley's stash before the show, whatever it is that he has in his stash, because she was so excited. She was interrupted by Emma and Dana Brooke. They call themselves NXT's welcoming committee and talk to her slowly because that's what they do in WWE when they sign a new Asian star. You know, next week they'll bring her out a big bowl of rice with a glass of sake. They told Asuka to leave the ring, and she did. I was stunned. And then as she got to the top of the entranceway, she looked back at the two of them in the ring, cracked a sadistic smile, as if to say, "I'm going to rip your insides out and string them up like Christmas lights." And I felt much better about how this ended. If I were Dana and Emma, I would be concerned. Kyle Edwards was back with another update on the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic brackets. On the live events this past week, Dash and Dawson upset the NXT Tag Team Champions, the Vaude Villains, to advance in the tournament. They will meet the winners of the match on next week's NXT, pitting Finn Balor and Samoa Joe against Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. Elsewhere in the brackets, Chad Gable and Jason Jordan wrestled the Hype Brothers. Actually, this took place this weekend. They beat the Hype Brothers, so spoiler. Well, they're just going to show highlights. It's not like I spoiled anything major. And so Gable and Jordan will meet the team of Baron Corbin and Rhino in the next round. They did not announce this here, but Cody and Dustin Rhodes will be at the next TakeOver show to present the winners of the tournament with a trophy in honor of their father, the American Dream, which is very cool. I would suspect that this is one trophy that would not get destroyed. This is it's a really tough one to call, this tournament, as far as who wins. I would love to see Gable and Jordan get the win, because I think it would be so easy for them to bring that trophy in as kind of their gimmick and start bringing it everywhere they go. But they would have to beat Rhino and Corbin in the next round, and I just don't see that happening. So I'm going to go with a Finn Balor, Samoa Joe against Rhino and Baron Corbin final, given that all four of those guys have had issues with each other before, they've wrestled each other. And Balor and Joe win the whole thing. And the tournament is just a setup for a Balor title defense against Samoa Joe on the December Takeover show in London. That's my prediction. Joe doesn't even have to turn on him. He doesn't have to turn on Balor when the tournament's over. He could just grab a mic and just straight up tell him, you know, what I want, what I really want, as great as this trophy is I want your title. And I'm going to take it from you. And just let the fans root for whoever they want to root for. You know, that's how I would do it. I don't think anybody has to turn heel. You know, not that I don't think it would be a role that Joe would do well in. I don't see them turning anybody here. I don't think they want to turn anybody. I think if anything like that were to happen, it would involve Hideo Itami. Hideo Itami is supposed to be ready to come back, I think, in October, November. So he is close to being able to come back. And so if they wait until December and they do that match as a championship match, a takeover between Joe and Balor, you could even have Itami involved. And maybe Itami actually costs someone the match, or he fingers the guy. Okay, that didn't sound right. He reveals... words, right? They matter. He reveals to the world the person who... I can't even talk about this now. Oh, boy. Wow. That was a horrible image. Anyway, let's move on from this. There's going to be something that happens with Hideo when he comes back, and I would imagine it will happen at the December Takeover show. Let's just leave it at that. Main event was the Vaudevillains beating Blake and Murphy with the Whirly Dervish to retain their NXT Tag Team titles. Alexa got involved at the very beginning, and so Blue Pants came out to chase her away. Match itself was, you know, paint by numbers. I'm not overly enamored with either one of these teams. Show ended with dueling taped promos from the back. One with Kaz and Enzo talking about their match with Balor and Joe next week, and then a Balor and Joe promo from the back. Both promos had all four men looking into the camera as they spoke to their opponents. And they were great. More of that, please. And while Joe was doing his promo, I think he touched Finn's belt and Finn kind of shot him a death glare, just for a brief second. Just so that you know, that was a subtle tease for trouble between the two of them down the road. I liked it. I was back in the Ring of Honor groove this week. I was able to catch the show on Destination America. The stars of New Japan were back on the show this week. First, though, they opened up with Silas Young and Michael Elgin, who I guess you can kind of say was a New Japan star, at least for the length of the G1. This was his first appearance back since he was in the G1 tournament. The fans are now calling him Big Mike, and he's got a big, bushy beard. He's way more over than the last time we saw him on TV. He gave Silas a running powerbomb into the metal barricade on the outside. That looked like it sucked. Rolled him back inside and gave him an Elgin bomb for the pin. And they were kind of teasing on commentary that maybe he would go soon for the world championship again. Yeah, maybe they can... I don't know, for some reason, I don't actually remember any specific match they had, if they've even had any big matches before, but for some reason, I think a match, like a feud or a match between Jay Lethal and Michael Elgin can actually be tremendous. And I have nothing at all that I'm able to base that on, other than the fact that I just feel like their styles would mesh well. So maybe that's the next feud for Lethal. ACH pinned Caprice Coleman with the Midnight Star, which is a 450 splash for the pin. Carino interviewed Caprice Coleman after the match and asked him, hey, what was in that envelope that Prince Nana handed you a few weeks ago, which I have no memory of? And Coleman said there was money inside that he took, because he's smart, but there was also a letter. And he had to read this letter to himself over and over and over again, but after another loss here on this show, he looked into the camera as if to tell Prince Nana, I get it now. And then he walked off. So it looks like Prince Nana may have a new client soon. Main event was 6-man tag team action. Roppongi Vice, Trent Barretta, and Rocky Romero, and the IWGP Heavyweight Champion, Okada, against the Briscoes and the IWGP Intercontinental Champion, Hirooki Goto, making his first appearance in the U.S. Okada was by far the most popular guy on the show. He just looks like a star. I was happy to read that interview that he did with, what was it? It was a Rolling Stone, I think. They were talking to Okada. And they asked him, hey, would you go to WWE if they were interested? And he flat out said, I'm never going to WWE. He says, I want to stay. I want to help build New Japan. This is my home. I don't want to see him in WWE either. They'd fuck him up. They'd call him the Rainmaker and make him a fucking Japanese Indian that does rain dances on his way to the ring. Stay in New Japan. To my surprise, Jay Briscoe won with the J-Driller to Beretta. I just thought Okada's team would get the win, so that surprised me. And that was it. Very straightforward, as it usually is. Good show, good action. Next week, it's Adam Cole, one-on-one with Shinsuke Nakamura. I love it when they have the New Japan guys on the show. Those are my favorites. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Dan, from Arlington, Virginia. Your Night of Champions review helped get me caught up after my trip to Vegas. I fortunately missed Cesaro jobbing to Big Show on Raw and on SmackDown before that because of that trip. I just shake my head at that booking. Makes no sense whatsoever. Cesaro's not old by any means. He's 35 at the end of the year. But this is two golden opportunities to push him properly. The WWE has now botched in 2 years. He's had some success, but the powers that be clearly see him only at a certain level. Could you see him going to Lucha Underground? Part of me can see it. Part of me wonders how he would fit in to that universe. You mentioned Cesaro turning 35 at the end of the year. You know, age should have nothing to do with it, given that they just headlined a pay-per-view with a 56-year-old guy, and they're headlining next month's show with a 50-year-old guy. And Sheamus, who's running around with that briefcase, is 37 years old. I don't know how many people realize that. Sheamus is almost, he's closing in on 40. He's a lot closer to 40 than he is 30. He doesn't look it, but he's actually 2 years older than Cesaro. So age has nothing to do with it, and if they think it does, then they're hypocrites. But to your question, I think Cesaro would fit into the Lucha Underground universe just fine. You know, just like Alberto El Patrona, he connects more, obviously, with the Latino audience. But, you know, Alberto came in, he was kind of the older vet, a lot of experience wrestling all over the world, made a name in WWE, came over to Lucha Underground. He's done very well for himself. Just because Cesaro is Swiss, I mean, they have people from all backgrounds and nationalities on this show, and he's already got the profile from being on TV for so many years. I think he would do just fine, but I actually think New Japan would be a better fit for him personally. I would love to see him in the ring with guys like Okada and AJ Styles. Can you imagine an AJ Styles-Cesaro match in the Tokyo Dome? You know, Cesaro wrestling a big match in the Tokyo Dome would be fantastic. And you could throw Nakamura in there, too. You know, I could picture Cesaro and Nakamura in the Tokyo Dome on, like, a future Wrestle Kingdom show. I think he would be a better fit there. John from Rockford, Illinois. With all the Eric Bischoff content on the network recently, I think they're setting up to put him in the Hall of Fame. I think he belongs there, as there is no Monday Night War without his work. Do you agree, and does he belong in? Well, I don't know if they're setting up for a Hall of Fame induction next year. I do know they're working on a Bischoff DVD release for 2016. He was just in Stanford working on some stuff for it. But absolutely, I think he deserves a spot in the Hall of Fame. Maybe they put him in 2017. If WrestleMania comes to Minneapolis, since he got his start working for Vern Gagne in the AWA, you know, maybe they would want to wait and put him in then. But he'll get in, as he should. You know, like you said, simply for the fact, if nothing else, were it not for him, Nitro would never have gotten 2 hours of primetime on Monday nights on TNT. And there would be no Monday Night War. Now, I think Bischoff was a one-trick pony when it came to wrestling. He's done very well for himself, riding off the success that he had those few years in the late 90s. But you can't deny the impact those few years had on the business. I mean, we're still feeling it today. When you put on USA Network on Monday night, just look at the show, the look of it, the feel of it, the format of the show. They're still following that same basic formula all these years later. The idea of doing monthly pay-per-views, which WWE then copied from WCW, and they still do to this day. You know, Bischoff took an idea that he saw in New Japan with the whole NWO thing. From that, he created or helped create the most successful wrestling faction of all time. You know, he brought in the cruiserweights from Japan and from Mexico. He did a lot of things that are very Hall of Fame worthy. I think Bischoff gets in, even though his body of work over a longer period of time is not as impressive. So his later run in WCW was a failure. His time in TNA, by and large, was a failure. If it wasn't, he would still be there. Bischoff has never recaptured the magic or the success that he enjoyed those few years when WCW was hot. But it was such a hot period, and it was so influential in the business that even though it was only a few years, he gets in without question. I think Heyman gets in as well for the ECW stuff alone, let alone the stuff he's doing today on TV. So all the key promoters from that Monday night period, from that Attitude Era period, belong in the Hall of Fame, and that includes Vince. And I think Vince goes in, obviously, at some point, but not until after he's already dead, because it would be very weird, I think, for him to induct himself into the Hall of Fame. Speaking of Bischoff, Aaron from Northern Ireland has a question. After watching the Legends with JBL show on the network, it has been brought up on both episodes by Eric Bischoff that even if Bret Hart took the WWF Championship to WCW, Bischoff would not have been able to use it on TV due to the, quote, legal issues of the time. If that was the case, surely both Bret and Vince knew this was the case. So does this suggest that the Montreal screwjob was indeed a work? You know, I had to put this question in there. I still get these questions. Even after all these years, and all the times I've talked about it, and all the people involved have talked about it, there are still people out there, conspiracy theorists, who believe that it was a work. And no matter what you say to them, they're just never going to believe otherwise. There's always going to be that doubt. And you always have to allow for some doubt. But I will say I am 99.9999999% sure, and 3/4, it was not a work. Point being, it was not a work. So there was nothing at all in that interview that would lead me to believe otherwise. I think it's foolish for people to still think that after all these years. And let's talk about that for a second. The notion that, well, you know, Bischoff says, even if I wanted to, I couldn't, because... Now, there is truth to that, because what had happened, there's a lot of legal issues between WWF and WCW. For example, when Hall and Nash came over, and Hall was basically portraying the Razor Ramon character without the Razor Ramon name. He had the toothpick, the curly hair, the accent, you know, everything but saying Chico. And WWF sued them, sued WCW. And they were suing them partially because, you know, they were giving the impression that they worked for WWF when they really didn't. And there was another lawsuit, I think, over the Medusa thing when she dropped the women's title in the trash can. And so what Bischoff says in that respect is true, that there were still pending litigation between the two sides. But the notion that, well, so I couldn't, my hands were tied, I don't buy that completely. I think if Bischoff knew that Bret Hart was willing to bring the physical belt over, I personally believe that Bischoff would have given at least some serious consideration to doing something with it, even despite the pending litigation. He was in that mode at the time of just wanting to stick it to Vince McMahon and stick it to WWF, and he knew he had the backing of Turner, and they were making money hand over fist, and they were conquering in the ratings. I don't know how scared Bischoff would have been to try something and then maybe play it off like, oh, I didn't know that would happen. So he says, well, I couldn't do anything anyway. He could have done something. Would he have? I don't know. But I don't see how any of this supports the argument that maybe it was a work. I think, if anything, it supports the opposite argument. I don't really see, you know, what you're trying to say here. You know, that Bret and Vince knew, because of the litigation, WCW couldn't do anything, so then why do the screw job? Because they wanted to get the belt off the guy. That's why, because Bret Hart was going to WCW no matter what. He didn't have to show up on Nitro with the championship. Legally, he couldn't. I think he was still under contract to Vince for a few more weeks, so I don't even think he could have showed up on Nitro. He didn't have to, though. In Vince's head, in his point of view, Nitro, which had a one-hour head start on Raw, by the way, at that time, all Bischoff had to do was open the show and say, we've got the WWF champion. The guy who is currently the champion of that other promotion, guess what? He's one of us now. He's coming over. Just the announcement, if Bret was still champ, just the announcement, we signed the WWF champion, in Vince's mind would have been death for his company, which it would not have been. That's an exaggeration. But it's not like Brett even had to physically be there for Bischoff to go on TV and make this damaging announcement. So in Vince's head, we can't have Brett as the champion. We've got to have somebody else as champion so they can't say that we signed their champion. And that was part of what went into this whole screw job plan that he hatched. So that doesn't even make any sense. I just wish people would drop this whole Montreal was a work. I can't believe people are still talking about this in 2015. Elijah from San Francisco. I was watching some old pay-per-views, specifically WrestleMania 20 and SummerSlam 2005, along with a few others, and people seemed to just hate John Cena on sight, almost from the start of his first world title reign, and ridiculously so, to die Rocky die levels. This was weird to me because of Mania 20 he was so disgustingly over. Every person in the building that night, not just kids and women, were chanting, "Let's go Cena." What got John Cena so over in the first place that he was made the top guy? Why did people turn on him so quickly? And why did WWE keep him as the top guy with such a negative response back then before he was the megastar that he is today? I was in grade school when all of this was happening and did not watch wrestling, so I have no idea. But you were there and have been a fan for years, so I was hoping that you could shed some light on it. Well, he got over on his own just doing the rapper gimmick. He was mostly on SmackDown. And he got over, I think it was also more like the promos, the battle raps, you know, wasn't as hokey and rehearsed and everything as it is today. Yeah, he would go out there, he came up with his own raps, he was very good. And just the whole persona, people gravitated to it, they came to like it. And he was very over, you're right, WrestleMania 20, giving the FU to the Big Show, not quite as over these days when he does that. And he stayed over for much of the summer of 2005, a good part of that summer. If you remember, he got drafted over to the Raw brand in June of 2005. If you go back and watch that segment, he got an insane reaction. Now, part of it was people didn't see it coming. It was a huge surprise when he debuted on Raw. But the people were going nuts for this guy. He's never, not before, not since, has he gotten as big of a reaction on Monday Night Raw as he got when he first got drafted over. And he walked out on Jericho's highlight reel. By August, you mentioned SummerSlam. That was the first time that I can remember the dueling chants. Let's go Cena. Cena sucks. That was the very first time I can remember it. So it was right around that SummerSlam period in 05, and he wrestled Jericho on that show. That's when it started. I couldn't tell you why, other than the fact that people started to pick up on this notion that, hey, wait a minute. You know, he's the chosen one. He's being shoved down our throats. I feel like maybe on SmackDown to some degree, it was almost like out of sight, out of mind. I mean, SmackDown wasn't as bad as it is today as far as how useless a show it is. But, you know, it was still, by that point, it wasn't like the SmackDown of 02, 03, which was the A show, in my opinion. He had his place on SmackDown. It was kind of his brand. He was on there. He was featured. He was over. When he came to Raw, it didn't take that long, and it just started to change. Because I think people had that perception that, okay, they're shoving this guy down our throats. And they don't like that. And I don't remember if it was any one thing they did on Raw. Maybe they were overexposing him to the point where people started to get sick of him, which they're certainly prone to do. They still do it to this day. But that was when, the first time I can ever remember that, the dueling chants and the real hatred for this guy was SummerSlam of 05. And it's been that way ever since. Now, why didn't they change course and go with someone else? Because he was moving numbers. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of ratings, in terms of tickets. I mean, if the guy was a total bust and people on top of that were booing the hell out of him, they would have moved him out of that role and gone with somebody else. But obviously, Cena was a difference maker for them. And he was getting reactions everywhere he went. He was getting reactions in every single match. His matches had the dueling chance, which was this, I guess, fun thing at the time. We're all kind of desensitized to it now. It's been 10 fucking years. But at the time, nobody else was getting those kind of reactions. And they picked him for a reason. You know, whatever Vince's reason was, he saw something in this guy or his, you know, he's a hard worker. Maybe some of the, maybe even then, some of the charity stuff he was doing. But he had to be moving numbers. Merchandise, I'm sure, was a big part of it. Maybe one of the biggest. I'm sure that had as much to do with it as anything. He was moving numbers, different kind of numbers like nobody else was at that time. I mean, who are you going to move him out for? You know, Batista had already been moved over to SmackDown. Are you going to move him back to Raw? Maybe they just didn't have another person to replace Cena with as the guy. But, you know, he was a difference maker, so they stuck with him. and they've stuck with him ever since. So that's kind of what happened with John Cena. It's become his gimmick in a lot of ways. You know, the dueling chants, some people like me, some people hate me. But at the time, I mean, there was nobody getting reactions like he was. So they said, hey, we're going to run with this. We'll run as far as we possibly can. And here we are 10 years later, and it just feels like, you know, not much has changed. Sherrod from Dallas. What was going on with the WWF Championship picture in the early part of 1997? Sid started as champion, then lost to Shawn Michaels at the Royal Rumble. Shawn then forfeits the title on Thursday Raw Thursday, so the four-way match at Final Four that had been scheduled is now for the vacant championship. Bret wins the title, then loses it the next night on Raw to Sid. What was up with that? I saw a Shawn Michaels shoot interview from 1999, and he stated that Vince did not have a set main event for WrestleMania 13 and that he and Bret were not going to be wrestling for the championship. So what was the original plan? Was Shawn Michaels to lose to Sid at Thursday Raw Thursday and then have a rematch at Final Four? And was the Fatal 4-Way match at Final Four originally a number one contenders match? Yeah, this is an interesting period in WWF history. So the original plan, I believe, had been to rematch Bret and Shawn for the championship at WrestleMania 13. They had the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12. Shawn won, Bret went away. The idea or the plan, I think as Bret had understood it, had been to rematch them for the title the year after. Somewhere along the way that changed. Vince changed his mind. And the plan had been to do Bret versus Shawn, but on the undercard. Almost like a co-main event. That would not be for the championship, and you could do Undertaker and Sid for the championship, right? The two big guys wrestling for the belt, and do Bret versus Shawn underneath. So Shawn lost the title in Madison Square Garden to Sid in 96, right? That was the end of his first run as champion. Sid had the belt for a few months. He was very over at that time. Shawn won the belt back. San Antonio, big homecoming, Royal Rumble, 60,000 people. They have the Thursday Raw special scheduled in February. And Shawn was going to lose the title to Sid. Shawn lost his smile. I guess he just forgot it at home or whatever happened. And he was talking about a knee injury. It could be career ending. The doctors don't know if I'll ever be able to wrestle again. Of course, 2 months later, he was back wrestling. Not only 2 months later was he back wrestling, or maybe three months. Actually, no, maybe it was 2 months. But all I know is at WrestleMania, like a month later, he wasn't wrestling, but he came out to do commentary for the main event, and this fucking guy is in the ring dancing. A month after, he was in the ring literally crying about a knee injury that could be a career ender. So excuse me if I don't shed a tear for Shawn Michaels and his phony bullshit at the time. So anyway, he's in the ring, he's crying, he forfeits the championship. They had planned a four-way match at the Final Four pay-per-view in February to determine a number one contender for the title at WrestleMania. That was going to be Undertaker, Bret, Sid, and Steve Austin, stemming from the finish of the Royal Rumble match. Because Bret had thrown Austin out, the refs didn't see it. Austin snuck back in, he threw out Bret. I think Undertaker and Vader were the other two. They were the final four in that Rumble match. It was Undertaker, Vader, Michael, I'm sorry, Bret and Austin. So that's why they were going to put him in a four-way match. Well, once Shawn got hurt and forfeited the title, the four-way match became a championship match. And so what I think, and this I don't know for sure, but what I think probably happened is Undertaker was going to win that four-way match because Sid was going to get the belt back from Shawn. Undertaker would win the four-way, he would get the title shot at WrestleMania, and you do Bret versus Shawn underneath. Now, where that leaves Steve Austin, who knows? I don't think Steve Austin would have had a featured match on that show. He would have been stuck in some other match. Austin didn't even know it was going to be a submission match between him and Bret. He had hurt his knee, he was sitting at home. So it wasn't like everybody was in constant communication with each other and knew what was going on. You know, things were fluid. Things were changing by the day, by the week. So I think that had been the plan. You know, Undertaker and Sid, you know, it wasn't a great match. It really should have been Bret and Austin for the championship. But we still got that classic match between Bret Hart and Steve Austin. And that was a match in a lot of ways that, you could say Austin 316 at the King of the Ring did, but that match with Bret at WrestleMania launched Austin into the stratosphere, and it almost didn't happen. You know, had the original plans gone through, it would not have been Steve Austin and Bret Hart on that show. Cody has a buy or sell for us, our first of three this week. You can tell I'm a bit backed up on those. What was the better heel run for Triple H as a competitor and a character? Triple H after winning the WWF title in 1999 to the point right before he tore his quad in 2001? Or Triple H as the World Heavyweight Champion from 2002 to 2004? Well, you people know my thoughts on the Reign of Terror. One of my least favorite periods in all of wrestling was that fucking Raw brand from 2002 to 2004. I hated it. Just absolutely hated it. SmackDown was fantastic for much of it. Raw was shit. And Triple H was a big part of why. Triple H in 2000 was maybe the best wrestler in the world. When you look at his in-ring work, his character, just everything about the guy, just coming into his own, certainly the best heel. That was my favorite incarnation of Triple H. I'm not hating on Triple H. That's the Triple H that I loved. Let's look at his run after winning the title for the first time in 99, right? So he beats Mankind on Raw. This was right after SummerSlam in 99. Now he's the champion. He goes on to marry the boss's daughter in storyline and in real life. He carries the company on his back with The Rock in 2000. Had a great feud, classic feud with The Rock. The matches they had back and forth, it was great. The love triangle with Triple H, Kurt Angle, and Stephanie McMahon. Great storyline that had a very abrupt, terrible finish because Triple H. That's why. But that was great for the time it lasted, I thought. Maybe not as much of a heel during that feud. In fact, it almost felt like Triple H was turning into more of the babyface, but it was still good television. His feud with Austin, when Austin came back from his neck injury, and then later on, the two of them as partners in the two-man power trip. I mean, there was a lot of good stuff, for much of which he was a heel. Like I said, the closest thing to even being remotely construed as a babyface, I think, came during that Kurt Angle, Stephanie, Triple H love triangle. But there was a lot of good stuff in there, right? Now compare that with the Reign of Terror. They did the brand split in 2002, and so they manufactured a second belt to literally hand to Triple H on TV. We got the infamous Katie Vick storyline that Triple H was right smack dab in the middle of. The classically awful matches with Scott Steiner, and who can forget their great pose down on TV, or their classic match at the Royal Rumble in 03. We had Biker Shorts Triple H, who had a torn groin, could barely wrestle, could barely move, but they still wouldn't take the title off him, even though Goldberg was getting hot, and they missed their moment to put the title on him in that Elimination Chamber match at SummerSlam, and Triple H just had to beat him first. And so then, you know, they had him drop the title to Goldberg in a boring match the month later. It didn't mean hardly anything. None of this made Triple H a better heel. None of this made me hate the Triple H character more. It was frustrating to watch, and to be perfectly honest with you, a lot of the time it was boring. His run made for boring television. I'm not even going to get into what happened to RVD and to Kane and to Booker T because it doesn't really have to anything to do with your question. But I hated that period so much. It was the polar opposite of what I enjoyed about Triple H's first real run as a heel, you know, late 99 into 2000. I'm buying that run all day long, and not only am I selling the Reign of Terror, I'm giving it away for free. Kent from Philadelphia, did you think it was a good move by Christian to go to TNA in 2005? I'd like to think he was on his way to the world title picture. I remember Batista said in an interview after Christian left how he was his favorite performer to watch and that he was sad to see him leave before he had a chance to work a world title program with him. I still think we were robbed of a very entertaining Christian and John Cena feud that summer, and I'm not sure why they didn't pursue it. Did Christian miss out on opportunities in WWE while he was in TNA, and why did he leave? Well, that was precisely the reason why he left. I'm with you. I thought they were heading for a program between Christian, who had Tomko with him at the time, very entertaining, Christian-John Cena feuding for the championship. I don't know if he would have won it, but they certainly could have had a program. They could have had some pay-per-view matches, and they never pursued it. They had some interviews, they had some interactions, but that was the extent of it. And it was because Vince McMahon did not see Christian at that level. And Christian has even, I think at the time, even talked about meeting with Vince, and Vince flat out said to him, you are never going to get above a certain level, because he didn't see him at a certain level. So Christian left because he had his legs cut off. It wasn't like, well, if Christian didn't leave, he would have wrestled for the championship. That was precisely why he left, because he thought the same thing you did. And then it didn't happen. And then Vince said to him what he said, which was insulting, quite frankly. And he left. That's why he left. Because Vince had his reasons for not wanting to pursue that. So you could say, well, did he miss opportunities in WWE? What opportunities did he miss, right? I mean, his goal was probably to wrestle for the world championship and try to get into some main events. And Vince basically said, no, that's not going to happen. So he missed opportunities to win, what, a couple more Intercontinental titles? Like, so what? He went to TNA. He actually won two NWA World Heavyweight titles, you know, whatever the hell those meant at the time. He had a nice little run for himself. You know, he felt he had to do it, and then eventually he came back. So I don't really think it hurt Christian really all that much. Because, you know, from what I understand, when he was coming back to WWE, they had a pretty big idea for him to come back as Jeff Hardy's attacker. They were doing a storyline at the time. And because it leaked on the internet and everybody knew, Vince freaked out and he changed plans to swerve everybody. So instead of it being Christian coming back in this big role on TV as the attacker of Jeff Hardy and probably having a WrestleMania match with Jeff Hardy, who was one of the most popular guys in the promotion at the time, they went with Matt Hardy. And that never works, because people never wanted to see Matt versus Jeff. It didn't work in 2001, it didn't work in 2009. And poor Christian was left out in the dark. They put him on that fucking third-rate ECW brand, and he did the best he could with it. You know, he worked with some of the younger guys. He had great matches with guys like, I think Swagger and him had some matches, and him and Ezekiel Jack. Probably the best matches Big Zeke ever had was with Christian on ECW. Christian, look, he did the best he could, like I said, but to go from what they had planned for him to what they did with him when he first came back was quite the step down. But it wasn't like a punishment for going to TNA. I guess that was the long-winded way of making my point. I don't think going to TNA hurt Christian at all. It's not like they brought him back with the express purpose of punishing him for going over there. They had a big plan for him. It's just that Vince lost his mind. And Christian did end up becoming a World Heavyweight Champion. It was brief. He had two runs, both of which were very short. But he had that great feud with Randy Orton in 2011, which was the feud of the year, in my opinion. They had this great matches back and forth. And that was probably as far as Christian really could have ever expected to get in WWE. So I don't think it hurt him. I think he had to leave. He had no choice. Pat from Connecticut, in your opinion, what has been the greatest year for WWE television since the company went PG, excluding 2008? And why would you pick that year? I would go with 2013, and I'll sum up the reason in two words: the Shield. We had an entire year of Shield six-mans on TV. Without them, that TV would have been trash. Absolute trash. I was not a big fan of that year's WrestleMania show. That was 29. But I thought overall, the Shield carried the company in-ring that year. Plus, we got the rise of Daniel Bryan, which, as a Bryan fan, was very cool to see. I mean, as disappointing as WrestleMania was that year, SummerSlam, I thought, was the best SummerSlam show in a decade. They had Lesnar versus Punk, match of the year, and John Cena versus Daniel Bryan. Bryan beat him clean for the championship, then Triple H turned heel, which is really the best role for him. It's the first time since 06, I think, that they let him be a full-fledged heel. And Randy Orton turned. That was the beginning of the authority angle, which I am completely sick to death of now. But when they first pulled it off, I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliantly executed. I was a big fan of SummerSlam that year. But the Shield, I mean, you cannot understate how important they were to all those shows, Raw and SmackDown. You know, and they had a little bit of a run there at the end of 2012. They had a run for maybe half the year, I guess it was, in 2014 before they broke up. But we had all of 2013. And if you put a list together of the top 10 or 20 TV matches, Raw matches, they would be in a good 80% of them. I mean, that's how good those guys were together. So if I had to pick one year, that would be the one. Armand from Maryland. I don't know if you've ever answered this question, but if you were a pro wrestler, what type of wrestler would you be? High flyer, technical, powerhouse? Well, not powerhouse, I could tell you that. And if given booking power, how would you book yourself from the day you debuted to your first mid-card title and all the way to your first run as the world champion? Well, if I were a pro wrestler, I would be mat-based because I'm not doing anything that's going to jeopardize my health. And if I could book myself, I would book myself to headline WrestleMania and win the world championship. And I would book myself into every subsequent pay-per-view main event. That's it. End of story. You asked the question, I gave you an answer. Luis from Brooklyn. Buy or sell. Bobby Roode and Austin Aries signing with NXT as solo performers or signing as the Dirty Heels tag team. Well, they wouldn't let them call themselves the Dirty Heels, but I'm buying them as a tag team, and I'll tell you why. I think they have a much better shot of making it on the main roster if they eventually come up together as a team and then go their separate ways later on, as opposed to trying to make it on their own. You know, Bobby Roode is great, but he's the kind of guy I could see getting lost in the shuffle very easily, like a Cesaro. Aries is a tremendous performer, but he's also small, which I personally don't care about, but WWE does. So if they come in and they get over as a tag team, it bodes well for them as single stars down the road. And you can't lose with those guys as a tag team. That first run they had together in TNA as the Dirty Heels was very entertaining. I was very upset when they split them up. And by the time they put them back together, you know, was it earlier this year or last year, whatever. I mean, TNA was so far gone, it was hard to even get excited for anything on that show. But that first run together as a team was tremendous. So I would bring them in as a team, because you could always split them up. And finally, John from California has a non-wrestling buy or sell. Walter White and Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad, or Rick Grimes and Daryl Dixon from The Walking Dead. Two great shows. Breaking Bad is probably, if it isn't my favorite show of all time, it's tied with The Shield. Not The Shield I was just talking about, the TV show, as my favorite TV shows of all time. I gotta buy Walter White and Jesse Pinkman. I mean, they were Breaking Bad, right? The thing about The Walking Dead, yeah, I mean, Rick Grimes is the main character. Daryl is awesome, right? Everybody loves Daryl. But it's not the Rick and Daryl show, right? The Walking Dead is an ensemble. There's a lot of different people who are part of that group, who are part of that cast. And so you can't just narrow it down to the two of them. And the interaction the two of them have is actually pretty limited. I mean, it's not like they have that many scenes together. So I got to go with Walter White and Jesse Pinkman. I mean, they were that show. And, man, what a fucking great show that was. It's hard to watch a show like that and then watch a show like Raw, I guess. I don't know. They love to talk about themselves as being anything but sport, right? We're entertainment. We're a two-hour soap opera. We're a two-hour movie, or 3 hours. I'm sorry, not even two. And boy, that's a tough sell, because now you're comparing yourself to shows like Breaking Bad, and that's just something you don't want to be doing. I'm trying to get my friend into it. He's never seen a single episode of Breaking Bad before. He's like, I don't know if I'm going to like it. I don't like watching heavy TV shows. I just want to watch and be entertained and laugh. I'm like, well, I can't say that you'll laugh much. You will laugh, but you've got to watch the show. It's just, it's too good not to watch. And I put that out to everybody who's listening to this right now. You know, some shows you just hear about and it's like, oh, they're so overrated. No. Breaking Bad is not one of those shows that is overrated. It's a masterpiece, is what that is. Speaking of masterpieces, that brings us to match number 2 in our countdown. My 8 of my favorite WWE matches of all time here as we count down to our 8-year anniversary show on November 8th. And this match is one of my all-time favorites, and I have talked about it on the podcast before. And in fact, and I tried to go back and find what school or college it may have been, and I couldn't find anything on it, but I know I'm not imagining it. Many years ago, it might have been in New England at some college or university, but they actually were teaching a course on wrestling. It was a course on pro wrestling, and I remember like the syllabus was online, and the match or one of the matches that the professor used as part of his college course to show people the very essence of what wrestling is all about and what made wrestling so fun at its peak of popularity was this match. This was a match that people had to watch for their fucking homework in college. Okay, that's how good this match was. And it was a match that took place in the Attitude Era. It was at the Over the Edge pay-per-view in May of 1998. And it was the main event for the WWF Championship between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Dude Love. And believe me, I never thought that a Dude Love match would make my countdown of favorite matches of all time, but this is the exception. The story they told, the match itself, the action, everything about it was so much fun. I like to point people to this match and say that this match is what makes pro wrestling so much fun and what makes me want to still be a pro wrestling fan. It doesn't have to be a 20 or 30 minute technical wrestling masterpiece. That makes me proud to be a wrestling fan too. I could watch a match like that in New Japan or even in WWE and be blown away and give it a standing ovation in my living room, okay? But that's not the only kind of wrestling I enjoy. There's lots of different kinds of wrestling that I enjoy. As long as it's fun and it's entertaining and I actually give a shit about the characters, that's all I ask for. And at the time, there was no bigger name in wrestling than Steve Austin. Him and Mick Foley, you know, they were friends for many years. And yeah, there were some Stone Cold Mankind matches, but they never really worked a program together. They had a match the month before this at Unforgiven. And it culminated in Vince McMahon taking a chair shot to the face at the end of that match. This was right in the thick of the Austin versus McMahon feud, because Austin had just won the championship, and Vince was trying everything in his power to get the belt off of him. And he really stacked the deck against Austin in this match, because Vince made himself the special guest referee. He made Pat Patterson the ring announcer. We had Gerald Briscoe as the timekeeper. So you look at this and you go, okay, now, surely there's no way Austin's going to be able to leave here with the title. They have a match. It's just a brawl. It's exactly the kind of match you would expect Austin and Foley to have. Austin was a brawler. Foley was a crazy man, taking crazy bumps. This was also at a time when WWE was actually putting some creative thought into their set pieces. So there was no ramp. It was just a very basic aisleway. But on either side, they had these flamed out cars. And it was funny, too, because I think one of the cars, they had spray-painted the name and number for the Briscoe Brothers Body Shop on the side of it, which was always funny when they would try to promote that. You know, Briscoe would come out, he was always so happy. You'd look at that and point to it, he was so happy. And you had Patterson as the ring announcer, who, of course, is doing these great ring introductions for Vince McMahon and for Dude Love, and they get to Austin, and he's calling him a foul-mouthed beer job. I'm not even going to give this man an introduction. And Jim Ross is appalled by this on commentary. He goes, oh, this man needs no introduction. And when the glass shatters, you know, it's amazing to go back and really watch the reactions that Austin was getting at his peak. And he wasn't even really at his peak at that point. I don't think Austin truly hit his peak until 99. But it was just incredible. I mean, the reactions this guy was getting all over the place was amazing. So the match starts. And one of the funniest things, the crowd is clearly chanting Vince is gay, because that's just what they did back then. And the announcers don't want to say that, though. So Lawler's like, what are they saying? And Jim Ross is like, I think they're saying Vince is dead. And I'm like, boy, Jim Ross has to get his hearing checked out. So the match is going on and on. They did some spots in the aisleway using the cars. I think Foley, if I remember, actually did a sunset flip to Austin, like diving off the car, and just he landed like back first on the floor, like on the pavement, because he's an idiot. So they worked some spots over there, and it's kind of funny to see Vince coming close with all these near falls. Like, if Vince really wanted to screw Austin, he would just hit three. He wouldn't hold up the count. But you got to suspend your disbelief. They come to the end of the match. Austin's bleeding. He grabs a chair, and he just smashes Foley right in the face. It's tough to watch any of these matches where Foley would take those chair shots to the head. This one he took right to the side of the face, and he covered him for the pin. Vince wouldn't cover him. Vince wouldn't count the pin. And Vince is wearing a referee shirt, by the way, that's about five sizes too tight. And he just will not count. And Austin stands up, he gets in his face, and he's jaw-jacking with Vince. Meanwhile, Foley grabs the chair, and you know what's coming. He goes to hit Austin from behind with the chair. Austin ducks, and Foley just demolished Vince McMahon with this chair. If I remember, it was like probably one of the dirt sheets or whatever at the time. I remember reading that Vince needed some dental work after this. It rattled his teeth so much. I don't know if his teeth broke or what happened, but he actually needed dental work after this. Foley hit him in the head so hard with this chair. There's no way Vince could not have been concussed. There's just no way. So Vince collapses in a heap, and Austin gives Foley a stunner. People are going nuts. There's nobody to count. Mike Chioda comes out. He goes to count. Pat Patterson pulls him out, punches him in the face. And Jim Ross really added to this. He's being Jim Ross. You know, he's going crazy. This is not right. Foley puts the mandible claw on Austin. Patterson jumps into the ring to count the fall. Now, the one thing I forgot to mention here is that The Undertaker was out there. You might be asking, why is The Undertaker out there? The Undertaker is the one person who volunteered to watch Austin's back in this match. And he's standing there the whole time, didn't get involved, until the point that Patterson jumps in to count the fall. Undertaker pulls him out, grabs him by the throat, choke slams him through the announce table. I think you have to watch the match yourself to really appreciate how fucking crazy the people were going. I think it was one long, sustained pop for the last, like, 2 or 3 minutes of the match. People are just going absolutely out of their minds. So poor Patterson has been chokeslammed through the announce desk. Briscoe tries to jump in to count the fall. Undertaker pulls Briscoe out, and he chokeslams Briscoe through the Spanish announce table. Austin gives Foley a nut shot, stunner. Vince had said before the match will only end by my hand. And so that played into the finish because Austin grabbed an unconscious Vince McMahon by the hand. He covered Foley and he smacked the mat 3 times to win the match. And it was so much fun just to watch all of the different things come together. Like, everybody was so fucking over in this match. That helped a lot. But it was just a fun brawl. But it had all those elements of what made wrestling fun and stupid and you know, exciting at the time. You had the chair shots, which you wouldn't find now, but at the time, you know, people went crazy. You hit somebody in the head with a chair, it was an easy pop. So Austin wins the match, and he's celebrating. Undertaker's looking up at him, and they were setting up the feud between them for months down the road. And Undertaker walks out. Austin's celebrating. That's where the famous soundbite from Jim Ross comes from, where he, you know, Austin's posing, and he says, Stone Cold Steve Austin is the toughest son of a bitch I ever saw to overcome this, and they show the replays, and my words really can't do it justice, and I hope my words are not overplaying the match. I'm not trying to, like, overhype it, but if you go back and watch, you'll see what I mean. It had all the elements that made wrestling so much fun at the time. You just have two guys beating the shit out of each other in the ring. It's a fun brawl, and you've got the story that's going on. As over as Austin was, people did not want to see him lose that championship. Whereas today, I think because they've created the sense of it almost doesn't even matter because you're going to get an automatic rematch, and I don't know, it's just people don't seem to care as much now. Even the characters that are actually over, whether it's Cena or Ambrose or Brock may be the exception, but by and large, people just don't seem to care the way that they used to because they've done such a poor job of getting people to care about these characters. But back then, everybody was over. Even the mid-carders were over. Val Venus was over. The Godfather was over. The Road Dogg was over. Everybody was over. And the main eventers were on a completely different level. They were in a different stratosphere altogether when it came to Austin and Undertaker and Rock. And so you have all these elements coming together. The story of Austin versus McMahon. McMahon getting hit in the head with a chair. Undertaker chokeslamming guys through tables, Austin giving people the stunner and flipping him the bird. I mean, it was great. I could see why that professor would have used that match as an example of, you know, just including all of the different elements of what made wrestling so much fun back then and trying to illustrate to people why it was so popular back in the late 90s. And this was a big part of why. And I think in some respects it's a forgotten gem, because I don't know that people really look back on this match as fondly as they should. They kind of, a lot of those Attitude Era matches, they kind of lump them all together. Some of them stand out, like the Hell in a Cell with Undertaker and Mankind. Maybe that first Austin McMahon cage match. But yeah, the Attitude Era was full of a lot of brawls. It wasn't really known for great wrestling like today's era would. You look for great wrestling matches. And why do you look for great wrestling matches? Because you're not going to get brawls like this. It's not allowed. The violence, the blood, the chair shots, you can't do any of that anymore. So I think people tend to gravitate, well, let's just see them have a great wrestling match. Back then, you didn't have to just rely on wrestling, because you had these larger-than-life characters and, you know, the weapons and the blood and everything else. It was just a different era of wrestling. And I think this match perfectly illustrates what made the Attitude Era so much fun. And I hope people go back on the network, Over the Edge 98, May of that year, and watch that match, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So that's match number two in our countdown. We have six more to go. We'll have another one featured next week as we march on to our eight-year anniversary episode on November 8th. Keep sending me your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com, and follow me on Twitter as well, @solemonster is my handle on there. One thing I forgot to mention earlier, but you can show your support for the podcast this way as well by buying a shirt in our store, prowrestlingtees.com/solemonster sounds off. That really is one of the better ways to show your support on Pro Wrestling Tees for this podcast, by buying a shirt. Or recommending maybe to a family member or a friend, if you want to buy them a shirt for their birthday. Might make for a good birthday gift. So go to prowrestlingtees.com/solemonster sounds off. We have up to a size 5XL on all of our shirts. They ship all over the world, internationally. Of course, you could still make a PayPal donation at solemonster.com if you want to, and use our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solemonster. We will be back for episode 403 next weekend. It's my birthday week. Wow, I can't believe my birthday's coming up. My birthday's not actually next weekend, but it's that final weekend before. But we'll be back for a show. I got you guys covered, don't worry. We'll also probably have a review of the network special with Brock Lesnar. That's airing on the network next Saturday, so I'll probably have some thoughts on that next Sunday as well. So that's something to look forward to. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you right back here for a brand new episode next time. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solemonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.